All right, welcome. I think this is the fourth lecture of the 1500s in Europe, December 15th. So we didn't have a class last week. It was Hanukkah, but we had a class the week before. And what we really did is we were learning about Rav Yoselman of Rosheim. And just a quick review to where we get up to is Rav Yoselman of Rosheim, I guess, would be called, I guess, in a Shtadlan, somebody who was working, who was very helpful for the Jewish community. What was very unique about him is that he actually got to petition for the Jews in front of the emperors of Europe, mainly two of them, Maximilian, and then when he died, Charles V. of Germany. So not only did he get to, petition the Jews, but he actually recorded everything. So for about 50 years of history, we have the recordings of what he did. And we have his diary, and it's just, we go through, it's just fascinating. And it's probably, there's no reason to believe that what was happening before he came on the scene and after he came on the scene, that it was that much different. The only difference is here, the Jews had representatives that the emperor recognized as the leader and gave him certain rights, credences, and papers that he was recognized by the throne to represent the Jewish people. So with these papers, he went to dukes and nobles, and he was able to go all over. So what I just thought I would do, I'm just going to go quickly, is to get to where we were 3 weeks ago. How many of you were here 2 weeks ago by the first election? Okay, so most of us were. Okay, so we had over here, we mentioned Yoselman of Rosheim. He was born in 1480, and he died in 1554. He started his work in like 1505 or whatever. So mainly was Maximilian and Charles V. That's who he was in front of, his family background. We mentioned in an earlier one that he was related to a doctor Loans, and they trace him. He is related to that doctor, and that doctor had an influence on Yohanan Ruchlin, who actually saved the Jews against Pfefferkorn, which is probably what we're going to learn very quickly. He brings down that in 1470, before he was born, his father had an incident where his father had to run for his life, and three of his brothers were actually killed by the because of a lie that was said by the peasants at that time. He, as a young man, he was a rabbi, a merchant, and a moneylender, and that's what his profession was when he wasn't running and saving the Jews. He brings down early in his career, before he was officially a Shtadlan, that there was a war between the Emperor and the Duke of Heidelberg, and within the battles, the army actually looted all the Jews. And he writes that, look, they stole everything. He was able to pledges. You know, this is common. If you took a pledge for a loan, and you can't return the pledge, they don't have to return the loan. So if they took those pledges, he couldn't get many loans back. He couldn't get money back. He ends up saying he doesn't say how, but he ended up getting some like 40 gold florins, and that kept him until I guess something else came in. But okay, we also mentioned, if there were three or four major things that we spoke about last time, one of them happened to have been Pfefferkorn. Now, Pfefferkorn he was famous. He was a Jew, and he became an apostate, and he was working with the church. And basically, he convinced the Germans, the from the church, he convinced the nobles to confiscate all of the Jewish books. I mean, we've seen that this was done in France. It will be done. It was done in Portugal also, and you know, this is to take all the Jews, the books, the Sfarim away from the books in Germany. Would have been just tragic. It would have been the end of the German Jewry. And basically, he writes what happened is it was just I have one slide here about it. But basically, what happened is they asked this humanist Ruchlin, which we mentioned before. He was a humanist. He was, this is what we talk about with the Renaissance. Thank you. He was a Renaissance man, and they actually, he was a jurist. He had law, and they valued his opinion. And he basically, Ruchlin came in and said, you know, after reading, he divided all the Jewish books into six parts. And he said, "There's only one small part of the books which are inconsequential that may say things against Christianity, but to destroy all of the books, all of the Sfarim, just for that small amount was definitely not worth it." And he saved the day for the Jews. Again, in the Renaissance, Hebrew as a language would make a comeback. This is a time period people are interested in ancient works. They felt that they were in the dark because of the Christian church for hundreds of years, and they were kept in the dark by the church, and now they wanted to find out their roots. They wanted to find out the old ancient Greek wisdom and Roman wisdom and Hebrew, and so it was in the intro, I guess it was like a thing to learn Hebrew and to learn about the Jewish wisdom and other wisdom. So to destroy the Talmud and other Sfarim were not, you know, it wasn't the Renaissance type of an idea. So it saved the day for the Jews. Yoselman, he records all this. And this is what he records. In 1510... Now, I'm just rereading this, you know, I'm bringing this down now because it's going to have something to do about 28 years later. This is going to come back. But in 1510, in Brandenburg, there were 38 Jews that were killed. There was a, whatever the story was, somebody defamed the Jews, and they said that they killed somebody, killed a peasant, another non-Jew, a traveler. And it ended up that they killed 38 Jews because of this. And basically we're going to see later on is that priest, what happened is the one who really killed the non-Jew confessed to his priest while the Jews were still alive in jail before they were killed. So this priest went to his cardinal and he says, "Listen, I got information. The Jews are really innocent. The murderer confessed to me. So let's save the Jews." And the cardinal says, "Nope, you're not saving the Jews. You just keep your mouth shut." And these 38 Jews were killed. What ended up happening is this priest, when we're going to learn either later today or tomorrow, when this priest, when Lutheranism became a big thing, when Protestantism became a big thing, he left the church because of this and he joined Luther. And it's going to happen sometime later where there are some of the noblemen, the dukes, are going to want to get rid of the Jews, and all of a sudden this incident is going to come back, and this incident that the Jews were falsely accused is going to help the Jews 28 years later. The story is going to come back. We will come back to the story. This is where Brandenburg was, and this is in Germany. This is the different places. Okay. At some point, he became, the Jews themselves asked him to be their regular shtadlan. So they said, "Look, we'll pay you. You go to places that we need you to go to." So at first, he first started in his area of Rosheim, of Alice and Lorraine, which is all the way on the the western side of Germany. And eventually, as he was successful, more Jews would call on him to help them. And eventually, the kings themselves he became the man. I guess at some point whatever he called, it wasn't there yet when he gave himself a title. In 1519, we mentioned last time, Emperor Maximilian passed away. Of course, when the emperor dies, so then the dukes, when the mouse is away, when the cat's away, the mice play. And that's when you have a lot of these dukes try to get rid of their Jewish communities. So the Jews of Regensburg and Dangelsheim, they both expel their Jews. Just that Dangelsheim and I think Regensburg also were cities, what do they call it? Emperor cities. These are cities that really were owned by the emperor. There's no emperor, so that's it. Get rid of them. But when Charles comes in, he ran around. He went to some of the bishops and the different other people to try to help them. But basically, this is where Regensburg is. And basically, when Charles came back, it was a big, big thing because he really reversed it. Reversed those expulsions. But again, without the expulsions, these were common things. Something that was so common in Germany. They got thrown out of a city, so they had to go to another city. Again, there were like 300 different princes. So it's not like, you know, the whole Germany was one place. They would have to go from one place to another. Not necessarily so far, but the fact that they had to leave their homes and go to another home and probably all the money that was owed to them they may have lost. And this was a constant thing that happened. But during this time when they had Rav Yosef and Rav Rosheim, he was able to stop many of these. What was very interesting about Charles, again, I don't know if I mentioned it last time, but I know I mentioned this, but that Charles was a very, very powerful leader. And he had, from his mother's side and his father's side and his grandfather's side, he inherited lots of lands. So at the same time as being the emperor of Germany, he was also the king of Spain. Most of the time he hung out in Spain, and he would come once a year for a few months to Germany. When he wasn't there, his brother Frederick was of Bohemia, who was his brother. He took, he was acting regent for Charles. But all the non-Jews were very happy that Charles was picked, because being the king of Spain, that's like there were no Jews in Spain. And for a reason there's no Jews in Spain, because they expelled all their Jews. And if you were in Spain at the time as a Jew, they would either kill you or force you to become Christian. So they expelled all the Jews. So when Charles now was going to become the emperor of Germany, so they were very happy. They said, oh, great, now we can get rid of our Jews in Germany as well. That's what the anti-Semites, that's what those that did not like Jews were thinking. But again, Hashem has his ways. And basically, he ruled in Germany very, very, he was very good to the Jews relatively. And he said, when they asked him, he says, no, Spain, what's the matter with, he says, because Germany and Spain are different countries. They're different. They have to be run differently. To such a point that Charles, he heard of Joselmann being the advocate for the Jews, and he renewed that. He says, under me, you will continue to be the representative, the official government representative of the Jews. And he also even expanded some of the rights of the Jews. And that was huge. For the Jews, it was a tremendously huge, gift, if you'd like to call it. Baruch Hashem, it was a big, great, great news for the Jews. So Charles at his time was the most powerful ruler. I mean, I'll see if I have a map of everything that he owned. Right as soon as he became emperor, he got them to be able to reverse Kaiserberg. They wanted to expel the Jews, and he got rescinding of that. Rosheim, he writes very funny, very interesting where he's from. He couldn't, they couldn't get the expulsion orders off the table. But they just kept getting a stay. Okay, so they're supposed to be kicked out in 2 years. Okay, when 2 years were up, they said, okay, we'll delay it for another 2-3 years. Almost like the Israeli embassy, you know. They just kept pushing off building it. Yeah, they kept pushing off getting rid of the Jews. And he writes, I know whenever he writes it, he says, even that day, they still, the expulsion orders have not totally been rescinded. Okay, I guess that's how the Jews have to live. You know, you never know. Maybe it won't be rescinded. Okay. He gave him a letter of protection for him and all Jewry, Edict of Innsbruck, which is also very, very good for the Jews. And also, again, Ferdinand, his brother, when Charles wasn't there, so he had to, Ferdinand was well disposed to the Jews as well. Okay? Peasants' War. So, just, again, we did this last time, just going running through it just to get the Peasants' War was a war where the peasants basically revolted against their masters, against the nobles and the dukes, and they wanted more of the pie. They felt that they were, and rightly so, they were mistreated and overworked and underpaid. But so what caused them to revolt? What caused them to revolt was really one of the main causes was Luther. Was the Protestant. Once he broke that stranglehold of the church, so, and you know, he his ideas were, you know, you have to be more free, it's not, you're not dependent on the church so much. So it like put it in the air to become more free and away from the church, and they felt that they deserved more rights, and they started to revolt. Now, they thought that they would get a lot of support from Luther, and one of the things that I guess they were very not happy about is that Luther did not support them. They supported Luther, but Luther did not support them. Eventually, they were put down very harshly. Thousands, I don't know, 10,000 of these peasants were killed by the armies of the dukes. But while these armies were going, while these peasant armies were going from place to place, it was no different than, let's say, by the Crusades, when you had the peasants, the rabble of these uncouth people going from town to town, wreaking havoc, just stealing money and killing people. So here too, that it was a tremendous danger. And what Joselman did is he went to the headquarters, the main place where they were all gathered, basically knocked on the door. it's amazing that they just didn't kill him. And he spoke with them and he reasoned with them. He says, what do you want from the Jews? Don't kill the Jews. It's not in your best interest. They're not against you. They're not with. So they said, well, why aren't they with us? You know, somebody said to Rav Yoselman, so have them fight with us. So Rav Yoselman answered in brilliance. He says, do you want the dukes and the nobles to associate you with the Jews? In other words, they'll say, oh, yeah, the peasants and the Jews, they're fighting together. You want that? They said, yeah, you're right. Okay, so the Jews are not fighting for us, you know, with us. And he extracted a whole bunch of promises that when they would do their wars, they wouldn't attack Jews. Huge, again, gain for the Jews. At some point, they reneged. But at least for a certain time, it held. I don't know if there was a certain other place where the peasants revolted and they did, you know, destroy, you know, and plunder and loot the Jews. But for overall, they didn't. Eventually, again, this movement was put down harshly, and most of them were killed, like in the thousands. So, but that was another huge thing that Rav Yoselman did to save the Jews. In the 1530s, if it's, you know, it's just like almost like reminds you of the in the 20th century in Europe, the Jews were accused of being the capitalists, and they were also accused of being the communists. Now, like, you know, so Elmai, you could say some Jews were, yeah, some Jews were, but like they were accused for everything, every ill. They're accused here, and they're accused of here. They're accused, you know, for spying on the Turks. Like the Jews in Germany wanted the Turks, you know, more than them. Now, it could have been that they would have wanted, because the Turks overall were better to their Jews, but it wasn't the German Jews. They were in part of the German, you know, society. For them to have the Turks wouldn't have been good for them. But nevertheless, they were falsely accused, and Rav Yoselman had to go down and disprove the claims that, no, we are not spying for the Turks. Okay, we mentioned also Augsburg. We did this as well. It was they made very, very important rules for business transactions. How much of an interest rate? At some point, I think around that time, they wanted to ask for interest. Jews can't charge interest. Well, if the Jews couldn't charge interest, that's it. They're finished. Because that's what they were, that's really what they, the only thing they had that they could do. They couldn't go into any of the guilds because they were knocked out of that. They weren't allowed to own land, so they couldn't do that. There was really very little for them to be able to do, you know, let's say some types of merchants, whatever. But the way they really made their money, they made their living, was through interest. So at Augsburg, they decided, they made like rules on how much interest they could charge, and that's, again, Rav Yoselman was very instrumental pleading the cause for the Jews. Everybody trusted him. The Jews trusted him, and the Goyim, they, being the representative of the emperor, they had to deal with him. He had a say in this. Okay. That was probably the last thing we've done, and now what we're doing is something new. This is something about Solomon Malko, or Shlomo Malko, is something out of a novel. I mean, this is, I don't know who would ever think of this story. If it wasn't true, nobody would believe it. I mean, it's like in a bestseller, you try to say, you know, hey, what about this is a story? They'll say, forget it, impossible. What was the story? Okay. Now, the story ends with Shlomo Malcho, who was originally he was a converso, and he made his way, and eventually he was killed, he was burnt at the stake, Al Kiddush Hashem. But what was his story? It started with this person by the name of David Ruvaini. This guy, David Ruvaini, he most likely was a charlatan. I mean, he definitely was a trickster. He shows up on the scene in Italy. And he says, I've come from the 10 lost tribes, and I'm trying to get together we're trying to get together our Jewish country, empire, trying to get together an alliance of other major countries to attack the Turks. That was the game plan. That was what it was. So this is what he wanted to do. So he went to Rome because he wanted King Charles V, the Holy Roman Empire. He wanted the King of France as the second army, Prester John, which the Emperor of Ethiopia, and his Jewish kingdom in Chavar, that's where they say if you read in Tanakh, Chavar is where the 10 tribes were exiled. So where was he from? Some people have him in Afghanistan, some people have him from Persia, where this Chavar is. But this is what he wanted. He had to get the King Charles V, he had to get the King of France, and he had to get the Prester John. Okay, and with these three and his army, they're going to take out the Turks. Okay, so how is he going to do all this? What's he going to do? So What else do you do? You knock on the you go to Italy and you knock on the Pope's door and you say, hello, can I talk with you? I'd like to. So he shows up in Italy, okay. Just wanted to show you, this is what King Charles, this is all of his holdings. It's unbelievable. The entire Spain except for Portugal, both Aragon and what's the other half called? But this entire area, they also south of Italy. I don't know if he had the Papal States, so he didn't have that. And then he was Empire of the German Empire, which is all this area. So this was his holdings. And if you counted the King of France, so now you have like basically all of Europe. So that was his idea: get Charles, and you get the King of France, and somewhere down here would be, I don't know where he came up with, Prester John of Ethiopia. I don't know where, maybe he had a big empire at the time, but all right, that was his plan. So how is he going to get to Charles, and how is he going to get to the King of France? So he went to the Pope and knocked on the Pope's door, and Kingdom Prester John, okay, so it was, if here's Eretz Yisrael, right, and this is the Arabian Peninsula, here's where the Ethiopia is. So he had a nice area in Africa. That was what Prester John did. This is where Ethiopia is today. So he had a nice area. So the three of them, and my country will take out Turkey. Okay. Actually, his idea was is get the Turks out of Eretz Yisrael, and then Eretz Yisrael will be for the Jews, and then Mashiach will come. Okay. Now, what did he do? The first thing is he went to the Pope, and he tried to set out to the Pope, look, I need your help. This is what I want to do. What could you do for me? What could you do? This is what we wanted to get out the Turks. Now, the cause is a very good one. The Pope likes the idea. All of Europe like the idea. So, but the Pope says, I can't get personally involved in this. So whatever reason, I guess the Pope felt this is not his jurisdiction. But he told him to go to Portugal. Because King Jao, or John, he is related, he married the sister of King Charles. So you see, I guess even Portugal was, somewhat related. And he'll be able to get an influence. You speak to the King of Portugal and he'll get you in with King Charles of Germany. So what does he do? He makes his way to Portugal. And that's what he does, King John III of Portugal. So he gets there, and he looks like a Middle Eastern type of a person. Maybe he's dressed like that, too. And so he shows up in Portugal, and he tells him this is what his idea is. He needs to get an army to attack all of the Turks. That's what he wants to do. He wants to take out the Turkish Empire. Now, the Turks really like the idea, because when the Turkish Empire conquered Egypt, it hit into Portugal's spice trade. See, they were using Egypt. That's part of, you get from the Far East, and they would go to Egypt, and from Egypt, they'd get whatever they needed into Portugal. When the Turks took over Egypt, now that was bad for business for Portugal. So they said, you know what? This is a great idea. If we can get rid of the Turks, the Ottoman Empire, and we can get back our spice trade. So the problem he had, though, at first he promised him 8 ships, 4,000 cannons, but the problem is that at that time, King John was busy persecuting the conversos in Portugal. See, there was a lot of Jews that were they were conversos. What happened? If you remember, when the Jews of Spain had to leave in 1492, so about half of them, everybody agrees about half of the Jews went to Portugal. Most of the Jews went to Portugal. Now, how many Jews left Spain? Some say as little as 100,000, some say as many as 300,000. That means somewhere between 50,000 and 150,000 Jews ended up in Portugal. 4 years later, the King of Portugal, Manuel, wanted to make a shidduch with the daughter of Isabel and Ferdinand, but the terms of the Tanayim was that you got to get rid of your Jews. So at first he said to the Jews, all right, everybody leave. But then he realized, he said, what am I, crazy? Can I kick all the Jews out? So he told all the Jews that they only could leave from Lisbon. When all the Jews came to Lisbon, he locked them up in houses and forcibly converted them. And he wouldn't let them leave. He says, I thought you converted, that's it. You don't have to leave anymore. You're all Jews. You're all Christians. So so for the next 20 or 30 years, he says, but we're going to do the no-tell, right? What was it? What's it called? The army? Don't ask, don't tell policy. And that lasted for a nice amount of time, for the next 20, 30 years. So maybe some of these Jews got out, some of them didn't, but at some point the Inquisition made its way into Portugal, and probably one of the reasons could have been as a result of of Luther, of the Protestant, because once they realize, you know, we'll talk about this more next week about the Protestant movement. So the church needed to get a stronger hold on what they owned, right? They didn't want to, you know, this problem of Germany applying everywhere. And when they realized that in Portugal there were so many Jews there, so they sent the Inquisition there. All of a sudden shows up David Ruvaini, and he says, we want to get rid of the Turks, and they need an army. So here he is, this king is on the one hand, he's killing Jews, and yet he wants to help the Jews get an army to kill the Turks. You can't make this stuff up. So he ended up, I don't know, at first he was stopping the persecution of the Jews, but somehow after about 5 months, he realized that David Ruvaini was a charlatan, or he fell out of favor, and he told him to get out of town. Part of it also is Ruvaini started setting up court, and Jews started visiting him from other countries. So now he had like a Jew, practicing Jew, opening a court. Another, and it made a big impression. It made a big impression on the Converso community, and because here you had a Jew, wow, and they were going crazy. As a matter of fact, there was one place where they got so emboldened that they broke into an Inquisition place and they pulled out. They saved the Converso that was in the Inquisition. So they got rid of David Ruvaini, and they told him, they sent them packing. Why is this so important? Because while he was there, there happened to have been one Jew, he was from a noble family, and he was a converso. His name was Diego Perez, if I'm saying his name correctly. And basically he was so enthralled, or so influenced by this dude, David Ruvaini, that he decided that he was going to become a full Jew. And that's what he did. He went ahead and David Ruvaini ended up leaving, and he went to the court in Avignon, where it was the other pope, and he ended up making his way around. But Shlomo Molcho, when David Ruvaini came, he wanted to join him, but he was rejected. But he circumcised himself, and then he ran to Turkey. So David Ruvaini is still on his mission to try to get this Turkish army, and this Diego Perez decided to become Jewish, and he becomes Jewish, and he gets out of the country and he goes to Turkey. In Turkey, he goes ahead and he starts learning Kabbalah under Yosef Taitesak. He was a Chashev Rav. He was like one of the Gedolei Hador of the time. So this is, he's learning Kabbalah from them. He becomes familiar with Yosef Cairo. And just a word with Yosef Cairo. Yosef Cairo, he wanted to, and we mentioned this in, when we learned about Yosef Cairo. Yosef Cairo, one of the hopes and hopes of dreams of Rav Yosef Cairo, was to die als Kiddush Hashem like Shlomo Molcho. He was hoping that's how he would die. And the Maggid was telling him that was a possibility, whatever it was, but that's what he wanted to do. We'll get back to them, getting to the end of the story. But this is who he was. So he went around and he started becoming, giving speeches, and he started going from place to place and learning. So this Shlomo Molcho, it seems that he was a real firm Jew, and he was taking everything seriously. And okay, so now Shlomo Molcho, he goes to Italy, but there were some Jews there. He started having Molcho, again, messianic tendencies. He's a Mashiach, with a precursor for Mashiach. So he comes again, he gets to Italy. This Yaakov Mantino said, I guess he was some head of the community, he threw him out. He didn't want to have anything to do with him. He couldn't deal with it. And he also wanted to go. He gets an audience with Pope Clement VII, the same pope that David Ruvaini had seen earlier, probably about 2-3 years earlier. And now Shlomo Molcho was coming to visit him, also for the same idea. What happened is Shlomo Mochel made a few predictions. He had like visions, nevuahs. One of the nevuahs is that there was going to be a flood in Rome. And guess what happened? There was a flood in Rome. So now people are saying, oh my gosh, like, you know, this guy called it. I think he had two or three other things. I'm not sure if those came true, but he was like, here he is. So now he's like a somebody. You know, the Pope says, oh my gosh, here's a person. He claims he's Mashiach or before Mashiach, and he's making Nevuah's prophecies, and they're coming true. Okay, so he also goes to the Pope, and finally he meets back up with David Ruvaini. And together they decide, together they're going to go to Charles the VII, Charles the V, Charles of the Emperor of Germany, and they're going to ask him to help get the army in order to defeat the Turks. That's what he's going to do. They said he carried a flag with the letters of Maccabee. Okay, Micha Mochabe Elam Hashem. Okay, so they're on their way to meet the Emperor Charles. Rev Yozelman knows this, sees this, and this is a train wreck. This is a very, very bad thing for him to bring up things about Jews and this and that. He's you know, very savvy. Rav Yozelman, he knows the climate, he knows the situation, he knows what's going on, he knows this is not good. And he tries to convince him, don't do it. It's not going to end well. It's not going to be good for the Jews. It's not going to be good for you. And they wouldn't listen to him. So what does Rav Yozelman do? He packs his bags and gets out of town. He says he does not want at all the king, the emperor, to think that he had any hand or any part in this. So he leaves. He leaves, and sure enough, they both come, and basically they put him in chains, and they took him to a place in Italy where they made a court out of them, and they were going to burn Mocha. Now, Mocha, you have to realize, any person that converted to Christianity that went back to become a Jew should be burnt at the stake. Right, so they knew he was a converso in Portugal, and now they found him. He's back on Christian soil, so they took him, and that's it. They were going to burn him to the stake, and they said to him, "Well, you know what? We'll save your life if you come back to Christianity." And to his credit, he decided, "Nope, I'd rather be burnt at the stake," and he was burnt als Kiddush Hashem, and this is. So as opposed to David Ruvaini, they took him back to Spain, and we didn't hear anything more of him. Some say he died in 1541 in Portugal, and some say he died in Lorena, Spain, in 1535. But that was the end of David Ruvaini. They took him also, and they just locked him up somewhere and got rid of him. So just it's so interesting that in his diary, in Rav Yozelman's diary, this is what he writes. He says, "During the time an Italian, Portuguese, a righteous convert, Shlomo Mocho, extraordinary idea to stir up the emperor by telling him that he had come to summon all Jews to fight against the Turks. I heard of his plan. I wrote him a letter warning against it, but he didn't. And I left Regensburg so the emperor would not say he had a hand in this. As soon as he came to the emperor, he was put into chains, brought in to Mantua, where he was burnt at the stake in sanctification of Hashem's name. He delivered many people from his sin. He was he wrote a sefer or two, and you know, he was a preacher, you know, he was a frum guy. May his soul rest in Gan Eden. Memoirs." What's missing here? Or should I say, who's missing here?
Ruvaini.
He didn't make any mention about Ruvaini. Why not? They both came together. So it could be, again, this is what people, you know, historians want to say, that he knew Ruvaini was a charlatan. Mm. He didn't want to give him the credit like he's something or whatever. And Shlomo Mocha was a sincere individual. He was wrong. He was, like, you know, off. But so this is okay. So this is like in Rav Yozelman's, you know. Life in his whole span is like one small incident. But in order to appreciate this incident, this is what was going on. The whole world was like in on this, like this crazy thing. All right, so that was the 1532. Next thing that happened is another thing that happened, and this is a, I think all Horowitzes, there's no Horowitzes in here, are there in the, but there's a, there was a town that was near Prague called Horowitz. And it seems that, that there was a family, there was a large family that lived in Horowitz, in the city. The city took on the name Horowitz, I think after the people that lived there. I'm not sure if people that lived there took on Horowitz, but the people who were there, they were all called Horowitz. The Horowitzes all probably come from the city. But in any case, at the time, in 1534, there was a big, big machlokus between the Jews that lived in Horowitz and the Jews that lived in Prague, which was nearby. And it really started to get out of hand. And like even the king of, I'm not sure if it was in Bohemia, or whoever the king was over there, was like, you know, hey, you guys, Jews, you better get your act together, which was not so good for the Jews. So what do you do? So, you know, the Prague and Horowitz, they're having such terrible fights and terrible things. So they decided to go get, they wrote to the rabbis of Posen and Germany that they should finally, you know, come up to an agreement. And he writes, Rav Yoselman writes in his memoirs that himself and an Avram ben Rav Avigdor, so the two of them were sent to make peace. But just notice how he writes about himself. And this is, he says, the great rabbinic mind, Rav Avram ben Avigdor, blessed memory, and myself, the inferior one. That's the way he always talked about himself. The lower, the inferior one. And they worked hard. They got down what all the issues were, and they came up with a 23-point reform. It was to improve the situation. He writes over here, more than 400 prominent citizens added their signatures to it. And that was basically the idea for it. However, there were some people that, I guess more, it sounded like more from the Horowitz side, that were calling out and just saying terrible things about Yoselman. And when this started coming out, so he writes in his memoirs that he had a lot of support. It was good from Rabbanim from all over Europe saying, how could you say that about them, and how could you, you know, this is not the right thing to do, even to such a point where he ends up saying that these communities ended up becoming ruined. But he writes over here that where is that? He at some point he was actually thrown into prison himself. Where he himself had to run into a palace, a castle, a few times because they sent some murderers after him. He had to run for his life, and he had to save himself by running into one of the local noble castles, places, in order for till it ended. And he ends up, the end is never good whenever there's machlokas, and this was no exception, that the communities, whether it was at that time Prague and Horowitz, it didn't end well. Bad things happen. By the way, just we may get to this later, but from this town of Horowitz, it was a person by the name of the Shalah HaKodesh. I think his last name was Horowitz. His Sefer, Shnei Luchos HaBris, is going to be a very popular Sefer. He's also a little bit of an historian, and he was, I think, lived in Horowitz. I don't know if that time or a little bit later, but he's going to eventually also make his way to Eretz Yisrael, and we have the Sefer Shalah came from this community. Okay, 1535, he travels to Brandenburg, Ansbach, and he was falsely accused and thrown into prison. Oh, there were people there that were thrown into prison, and he had to obtain their freedom. Okay.
What is the Margrave?
Huh? It's one of the Margrave, there was seven electorates of the emperor.
Seven
electorates. It was even though there were like 300 princes, mm-hmm. but there were seven main ones. One was Brandenburg. So the Margrave, that was, I think, a title. The Margrave of Brandenburg, which this one happened to have been George. Okay, so they had, the seven of them had different titles. I forgot, you know, what they are. Okay, Cilicia. This is This is also something which is, again, wild. Again, you probably would not even believe this if it wasn't true. Cilicia in 1535, again, the Jews in Cilicia were imprisoned, and he had to travel all the way to these places together with Rabbi Lieberman to help get them out of jail. Why were they in jail? He says, even though two or three of them were burnt already, but the rest of the Jews he got out. For what? For witchcraft, concerning pig's milk. Okay, so in this time, for whatever reason, witches and witchcraft started becoming popular in Germany. And I guess 1500s, I guess when Salem was also probably a little later, I guess it was just a thing to do, or a thing to be afraid of then. The story, if I have it correctly, was that there was a lady of ill repute that claimed that this Jew came to him and asked him for the blood of either the I don't know if it was the blood of a the milk of a non-Jewish lady, or the blood of a non-Jewish child. And she testifies that instead of giving him the blood of a, or the milk of a non-Jewish child, I gave him the milk or the blood of a pig. And she claims that he took this, I forgot what it put it, made a whole potion, and in the potion he heard oink, oink, oink. So he said to her, he says, "What'd you do? I asked you for a non-Jewish child, not a pig. Now I only have control over pigs. I don't have control over non-Jewish children." That's what she testified. And that's where they threw all, in Cilicia, that's where they picked up all these Jews, and they threw them in jail, and they burnt three Jews because of this. And if not for Rav Yozelman, they would have probably killed the rest of them. It's just mind-boggling what people believe and what they have to go through. I just have one more. So again, he says he spent over 600 gold florins. You know, I guess he keeps a running account of how much he spent. Sometimes it was less, sometimes more. Okay, just one other thing. Okay, we're gonna speak more about Martin Luther. Luther, he called him Lotahar, but eventually, originally he was pro-Jewish, and he said nice things about the Jews, hoping the Jews would convert to him, like, we're not the church, so of course you want to convert to my new religion. And when he realized that they weren't, then he turned, and he said terrible things about the Jews. So, but I don't want to focus on that now, but what happened is, 1536, Herzog Hans of Saxon was another one of the seven electorates, and they wanted to forbid any of the Jews to travel in his land. And of course it was because of the influence of Martin Luther. So he had to go ahead and deal with this. He had supported letters from other people, also with the Prince of Brandenburg, and basically he was having a hard time convincing them. I think he had to, so again, what happened is while he was trying to convince him that Martin Luther, all the lies that he was saying was wrong, right, and you shouldn't be harsh on the Jews, don't kick them out, allow them to go through your land, this is what I told you before, this incident became to light then. So this was when, in 1538 was this? This was in 1536, so 26 years later, this incident that I told you, while he was trying to convince them to allow the Jews to go free, to live there and pass through, and the lies that the Jews are, the people are lying against the Jews, and what you're hearing from a person named Bussard and Martin Luther was not true. This came to light. And this priest was an old priest. And the testimony made a big impression on the electorate of the Saxony. And because he heard, I think it was actually his grandfather that this happened under. That and he found out that now the 36, I'm sorry, what was it? How many Jews were killed? 38 Jews were killed, and the priest, this whole thing about the priest came out that he heard the confession of the murderer and he tried to stop it, but the cardinal said no. And you know, I guess almost like maybe his grandson wanted to right the wrong, but it made an impression and that stopped everything and things. He was able to get through to them. And they did not allow this to happen anymore. He ends up that the Prince of Saxony went back on his promise, but Hashem humbled him because he doesn't say how he humbled him, but he was humbled at the end. Okay, and it says, yeah, here it is. He says the priest who heard the confession claimed he was forced to make a fast. He was still alive. He now lives near Wittenberg, and the Jews everywhere that permission to travel freely in his domain. Okay? All right. I think... okay. I think this is probably where we're probably going to end. Martin Luther, I think we're going to pick it up next time with Martin Luther. Okay? How did it start? I mean, he just came out of nowhere. And before you know it, now Protestant is like a major split from Christianity. I mean, from Martin Luther today, it's probably the biggest effect, biggest change in the church since its inception or since its very inception. So we'll pick that up with Martin Luther next, Mr. Shem next week.